Welcome, everyone. Today's April 3rd, and I open the House Committee on Human Services and Housing. And we are going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3292. Representative Sherry Springer and Representative Jennifer Williamson, please come up, and Robin, please read the bill.
Oh, yeah. Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3292 directs Oregon Health Authority adopt rules identifying activities landlords may contractually delegate to renters of tourist facilities, relieve landlords of liability for tenant failure to meet terms of contractual agreement. There is a very minor dash one amendment that makes small, pending dash one amendment that makes small language changes that I think the representatives plan to speak to.
Thank you,
Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Sherry Springer, state representative from House District 17 out of SIO, and I'm excited to bring you House Bill 3292. And very brief history on this. This was handed to me like days before the deadline last session, two years ago in the 13th session, and it was all supposedly cleaned up, and I said, well, this isn't quite how I do a bill, but let's give this a try. It didn't work so well. It just didn't work so well. There were some language problems, and so thankfully Representative Williamson has worked with me on this, and we've accomplished the same goal without upsetting, to my knowledge, anybody. And so I'm quite pleased with that. So this bill came to me from one of the constituents in my district, lives down the road a few miles, runs a church camp, Camp Tadmore, which I've been going to for a whole bunch of years. And there were some inconsistencies and, frankly, some concerns in the language about who had liability for what. So I'll give you two examples, real-life examples. So the church I'm affiliated with, oftentimes we will say, hey, winter camp, Camp Tadmore, yay, let's hope it snows. And we go up there, and sometimes, myself included, we bring our kitchen crew. And frankly, the day before I was appointed and 2 days before I was sworn in this legislature, I peeled 70 pounds of potatoes at Camp Tadmore. So, yeah, it was quite a prestigious moment. But anyway, sometimes we bring our own staff to cook the meals. Well, that's fine. And the pastor hands out the forms and says, can your kid go? You say, yeah, any allergies, bee stings, health problems, medications, fine. Signs the form, and they go. And I've got to tell you, in every single one of those circumstances that I've been up there, and it's been a bunch, not because he doesn't work, not because of any particular reason, I never see the director of the camp. Never have any contact with him. We go up and we run our camp in a facility that's rented, just like the convention center and just like a state park. But those two entities enjoy liability protections that these camps don't. So another scenario is Camp Tadmore puts their posting up and they say, we're having a camp for whatever reason. Come and join us. Here's your permission slip. Mm-hmm. Fill it out. Allergic to anything, medications, those kinds of things. And they assume responsibility for that. They never see the forms when our church goes up there for a church camp. They don't check the temperature of the meat because we have assumed that responsibility, yet they're not protected. And so that's the problem that we're trying to solve. And I'd remind us all, as I looked into this, our convention centers enjoy that protection. Our state facilities enjoy that protection, but these camps don't, and it's unclear. So that's what this bill does, and the amendment, I got to tell you, these folks behind me are all over this stuff, and they know their rules and regulations. They had a couple concerns that we have addressed in amendments. One is this would cover camps that are 1 day or more, not 2 days or more, and that they could have multiple camps there. Some of these facilities are very large. I think every time I've been up at Tadmore in particular, there's been another camp, and so when you get to the roads, you either go this way or that way, and the whole facility is rented out. And they don't want to be restricted to just one. So that's what the bill does. That's the problem that we're trying to solve. They're going to talk to you maybe a little bit more detail there. And I know Representative Williamson has some particulars here that she wants to hit as far as the law, and thank you so much.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Jennifer Williamson. I'm the state representative for House District 36, the west side of Portland. And I was very excited to work with Representative Springer on this bill because we knew what the problem was, and we couldn't figure it out in the time frame in 2013 to make people happy. And we ran out of time, and so we worked over the interim with camp groups, with lawyers, and with folks who rent and own camps, everybody who's involved in these kind of operations, to figure out who needs what, who has what liability when. And so the bill basically lays out what liabilities can be delegated, when they can be delegated, and who has to be responsible at certain times, so that the landlord is responsible for the rope course, but the camp who rents it is responsible for the employee or the volunteer who runs the rope course. So it was that kind of designation that that we were able to memorialize in this bill. So I can walk through each of the parts if you want about what can be delegated when or not, and open it up for questions.
Does anyone have any questions about what can be done when? I'm just going to assume that since the camp is not assuming the liability, that they will only accept renters who do have their own liability insurance, correct?
I think I know the answer
okay.
to that.
Okay. Well, I see people nodding behind you.
To that.
So, yes, I'm assuming because, yeah, I'm actually a little surprised it came to this committee instead of, like, consumer protection or something else. But as long as somebody who gets injured, you know, if there was any problem, negligence or whatever, they had recourse, and somebody is held responsible.
Yeah. Madam Chair, may I?
Yes.
To address that a little bit more specifically, that really was the issue,
yeah.
Is who is responsible for what, when.
Yeah.
And frankly, most of the camp folks want responsibility.
Uh-huh.
They, in fact, the first bill mentioned something about pools. It would include pools in the list of things they weren't responsible for.
Yep.
And one of my folks came to me and he says, no, it's our pool. Mm. I want responsibility for the pool. I take care of the pool. I know when we need lifeguards. They said, no, we want responsibility for certain things, and we'll take the liability for that. But it was when they had when they didn't see the form that says the kid is allergic to bee stings.
Right.
Or they're not preparing the food, so
right.
they didn't stick the thermometer into
right.
the hamburger.
Right.
That's the kind of thing that they're really concerned with. In fact, like the ropes course, they maintain responsibility for the ropes course. They're very particular about some of those things, and I'm glad they are.
Yeah, so the physical facilities they're responsible for, but the activities, basically, the renters are responsible for.
Right, and it makes it very clear, Madam Chair, what can be delegated and what can't be a contract.
Right.
So
right.
From a protection standpoint, you know, as a landlord,
right.
These are the things that you're responsible for, and it's
yep.
very clear. And as someone renting, you have the protection of knowing, you know, I'm responsible for this set of issues,
mm-hmm.
and the rest is up to you. And so it makes it very clear what kind of insurance you need
mm-hmm.
and what you're insuring.
That's great. Any questions? Thank you, representatives, for bringing this to
Thank
us.
Thank you.
Okay, and I will now call up Dave Burtz, Dennis Littlefield, and Marissa Bennett, please. Thank you for coming.
Thank you, Madam Chairman and members of the committee. We appreciate the opportunity to offer testimony in favor of this bill today. My name is Dave Burtz. I'm the Director of Operations for Camp Tadmore, which is outside of Lebanon, Oregon, that Representative Springer referenced. And the representative has done a great job of outlining for you the intent of the bill and our desired outcome. And to clarify a little bit more on your question about responsibility, what Representative Springer said is actually very, very accurate. We want to be responsible for the things that are within our control. So anything related to the facility, the ropes, our lake, for example, we are, you know, that's our thing. But when a group comes in, and by contract, we lease to them, and we don't have any control over what their participants or their counselors or their leaders are going to do, there's just no practical way for us to be responsible for that. But this bill allows the health authority to work with us to write rules that will specify what we can, by contract, place responsibility onto the tenant for. And so that's really what we've been working for a long time. I've been involved in the last two rounds of rules writing with the health authority, and this is the point that we keep running up against and having the problem is we try and write rules, and they're good, but there was never any way for us to not have responsibility, even if we had a contract with a guest group. And so in working with them, getting a bill like this passed that will allow us to make another revision to the rules that will designate what those things are is going to be very helpful. Camps are way different now than they were 20 or 30 years ago when all they did were summer programs primarily, and we are much like a retreat center, conference center, even hotels and schools that rent their facility to other groups and don't have responsibility. But because of the way the statute currently is written, organizational camps, which is what we're licensed as, do still have to maintain that responsibility. So we appreciate your consideration of the bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Dennis Littlefield. I'm the director at Camp Tillicum in Newburgh, Oregon, and I concur with everything that's been shared so far with all of these things. I think the camp community, the organized directors of these camps, are completely supportive of these changes. They're very, very helpful. As an example, when the health department would come out to visit your site every year to work through the administrative rules and ask you questions, it was always very confusing because they would say, "Where's your nurse?" They would ask, you know, things that wasn't applicable if the organization that was there at the time was a rental group. Mm-hmm. And so it created this strange tension that was always very confusing for both the owner of the site and the individual from the health department, mm-hmm. as far as how you managed these list of questions that didn't actually apply mm-hmm. in what we were doing at the time. And so I submitted my document earlier, and so I'm not going to read any of those things specifically, but we're very supportive of this bill. Thank you.
I'm Marissa Bennett. I run Camp Namanu, which is a campfire camp outside of Sandy, Oregon.
Sure to shine. All yep, the time. Yeah.
And I think one of the biggest pieces for us is that the reality has changed. We're not just a summer camp. We run facilities 52 weeks a year, and we run everything from weddings and retreat groups. We have folks come up from California and film 3 to 4 times a year, web series running. So I have a gamut of folks running youth camps, folks running, you know, the movie industry. And those rules look different, and I need to be able to hold them to different liabilities and allow them to hold that liability when I'm dealing with all adults or when I'm running a program with kids. We're an ACA camp, which is the American Camp Association. We choose to go through a much more rigorous accreditation than the state standards will ever hold us to. Mm-hmm. And to ensure that safety, we want to make sure that our kids are receiving that. And ACA has figured out ways to allow us to advise rental groups of things that they should be doing. You know, if you're serving youth, of course we should advise the user group to have background checks for everyone working with youth and having access to them. So we have those ways in place already to make sure that we're doing it. Where we were running into the problem was what the statute was allowing us to do, so we couldn't give away that liability and being able to share that liability with our user groups. And again, yes, we definitely are insured. They're insured. We're making sure we advise them of all those health and safety things that we know about and fully responsible for facility. We always have folks there for them. You know, if there's a maintenance issue, if there's somebody there for them right away to help that user group through that reality. But I want, you know, we're just looking for the same kind of rules and regulations that a state park or a hotel, you know, if you ran a camp at the Hilton, you'd have that same expectation. If you provide a lifeguard, it's clearly posted, no lifeguard on duty, your job. That's, you know, just getting that in line with everyone else as we live in this new industry of retreat center and tourism that I didn't realize 40 years ago when I made this life choice where I was going, but here we are. So I learn new skills every day. So thank you.
Great. Any questions? This is a great bill. Thank you all for working on it. Seems like it's providing a lot of clarity. So
thank you.
Look forward to having a work session in the future. Thank you so much. Going to close the hearing on 3292, open a public hearing on 2195. And Christine Lewis, if you'd like to come up while Robin reads the bill. Or, no one else signed up, but feel free to... Yes, I didn't see the names right next to yours. Chris Vick and Randy Walniff, too. They're all on one line, so...
Sorry.
All right.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2195 requires counties use funds collected for delinquent tax lien foreclosure to provide low-income housing, social services, and child care. There is a dash one amendment pending. Applies the statute to counties with populations of 650,000 or more, directs that the funds be used for housing rental assistance and affordable housing development.
Good afternoon, Chair Kenny Geyer, other members of the committee. For the record, I'm Chris Fick with Multnomah County. Thank you for holding this hearing on this important bill. This is a priority bill for Multnomah County because we think the need for housing for homeless families and their children is such an important investment, so we greatly appreciate it. Just to provide a little bit more background on the bill itself, and then I'll turn it over to Christine and Randy. Right now, if someone fails to pay their property taxes, it's a tax foreclosure, and the county can seize that property. We thereafter have the ability to donate it for a couple different purposes, affordable low-income housing, social services, child care, and open space. In Multnomah County, we take possession of, on average, 18 properties a year. We donate about 3 to affordable housing and low-income housing in particular. And we collect, on average, about $600,000 after we deduct our expenses in dealing with the property, cleaning it up, and then reselling it. So it's a modest amount of money that we're talking about. Thereafter, what we do, though, is we distribute it to all the different taxing jurisdictions. So it's sprinkled out over the county. It doesn't make a huge difference in anyone's bottom line. Yet we're working with our local partners around homelessness issues. And in the region, both with the city of Gresham, city of Portland, our school districts, we've identified the issue of homeless youth and their families being a huge priority, not only for our county, but for our overlapping jurisdictions as well. So after notifying them of our intent with this bill, we are looking to dedicate the proceeds from the sale of these properties and be able to dedicate that to homeless youth services. The bill stipulates it can go towards housing placement and retention support services, flexible rental assistance, and new low-income housing for people and families making less than 30% of the median household income. This is a very important tool. It's not a cure-all. It's not a huge pot of money. We think it's an important step to help us deal with this issue locally. We'll be happy to answer any questions you guys have.
Thank you, Chair Kenny. About how much money does it generate? Who's my
first? On average, $650,000.
A year.
A year.
Okay, follow up?
Yep.
Can you be more, I love the idea that you're wanting to help homeless youth since it is such a huge problem, but what will the money be used for more specifically?
So the delineated purposes, and Christine can give you more information, but it's housing placement and retention support services for youth and families with children, flexible rental assistance for that same population, and new low-income housing for families and families with children with incomes less than 30% of the county median average, or the county median.
Oh, one last question. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Chair Kenninger. So what about unaccompanied homeless youth? Is that...
They would be covered as well. Yes, it's both youth and families with children.
Unaccompanied youth. Okay, thank you.
Chair Kenny Geyer and members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to testify today in support of this bill, which will allow Multnomah County to dedicate funds from the sale of tax foreclosed houses to respond to the needs of homeless youth and families with children. For the record, my name is Christine Lewis, and I'm here on behalf of Multnomah County in my capacity as Policy Director in the Office of Commissioner Jules Bailey. During the 2013-14 academic year, 2,985 students in Multnomah County Public Schools, it's about 4.1%, reported being homeless, well above the statewide average, about 3%. This problem presents multiple challenges for school districts, social services providers, public safety officials, and others, and requires new resources to adequately address these issues. The data is still being processed from our 2015 point in time count. That's the street homelessness and shelter temporary housing count. But we expect those numbers to bear out a similar need as the school district's numbers, while also helping to capture numbers for toddlers and youth outside of the school system, as well as householding families experiencing homelessness with more than one child. Multnomah County, under HUD guidance and in partnership with the cities of Portland and Gresham, with Home Forward, our local housing authority, and Meyer Memorial Trust, has formed a shared governance structure for our community's efforts to address the crisis in homelessness. Chair Deborah Cafori and my boss, Commissioner Bailey, serve on the Home for Everyone Executive Committee on behalf of the county, alongside the mayor of Portland, commissioner from the city of Portland, a commissioner from the city of Gresham. The committee has just adopted an ambitious community plan under Home for Everyone. We have two measurable goals. One is to end veterans homelessness by the end of this year, 2015, and the other is to reduce the unmet need of those experiencing homelessness by half in the next 2 years. And we've prioritized vulnerable populations, so that's homeless youth, women fleeing domestic violence, families with children, as well as those veterans, as previously noted. Our community has received significant federal resources to aid, especially in placing veterans, and the Veterans Administration and HUD are working with us, and we're currently placing about 70 veterans a month in housing. Our Home for Everyone jurisdictions are preparing their annual budgets, and we're hoping to align policies and resources to be as effective and efficient as possible. We expect significant commitments of new local resources to reduce unmet homelessness, those needs by 50% within the next 2 years. And we also seek to engage the community and leverage new resources among business, philanthropic, and faith communities in order to help us meet those goals. We support 2195 so that we can use funds from the sale of foreclosed properties to invest in this larger plan, this community's plan to increase flexible rent assistance and retention activities to move youth and families into housing, and then to provide them with the supports to keep them housed. That's especially important. We're also gonna create more affordable units for these very low income populations, since the tight rental market actually creates some of the barrier to get folks back into housing. There's a nexus here, I think, with the issue of displacement and moving people through homelessness back into units. And we believe that investing these funds is a strategic and coordinated plan to address the crisis of homelessness is the highest and best use of these public funds. We are pleased that this bill has the support of our largest taxing districts. That includes the cities of Portland and Gresham and Portland Public Schools. Thank you for allowing me to provide testimony, and happy to answer any questions about our housing programs.
One question, the taxing districts, what about the other school districts in Multnomah County?
Chris?
Chair Kinnegeyer, we notified all the taxing jurisdictions. That includes Reynolds, even parts of Lake Oswego, Park Rose, Centennial, Gresham, Barlow. We only heard back from a select few. None had concerns about the proposal.
Thank you.
Oh, no, go ahead. Chair Kinnegeyer, members of the committee, my name is Randy Walroff. I'm the Multnomah County Assessor, Tax Collector, and unfortunately at times the person that does the foreclosures, and I manage tax title properties also as part of my integrated office. My first reason for being here today is to answer any of your technical questions or in-depth questions about how the funds and how we do the donation process or the auctions. But I just had one story to tell about when I have to foreclose properties. There are times that they're occupied. And one story came to me, it's just been the last couple years. We were out in Rockwood and we had a property and it was dilapidated, it was foreclosed on, and it was being occupied by the disabled father and three teenage girls. We had virtually no resources to rely upon. Fortunately, in this circumstance, I actually found a, my staff did, a nonprofit that actually came in and was able to help move them to another property that the county had actually donated to the nonprofit the year before. So donation is allowed in the statute right now and occurs, but many times it's not a very viable option because these properties need a lot of work. So it's hard for nonprofits to come in and take these properties because they're not remodelers, they're social service mm-hmm. organizations. So I see this as a tool that my staff will also have to have social services available, mm-hmm. hopefully enhance social services to deal with these people, because the last thing we want to do, and our chair is committed to not putting people out on the street. So unlike a typical bank foreclosure, we're stuck in a rock and a hard place, scrambling for resources. And I view this as the person in charge of this program, that the county would have additional resources to help when we have this situation, along to all the other great purposes that you've heard today. Thank you.
Any other questions?
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer, and thank you for your presentation. My OLIS is now in here for some reason. I can't bring this bill up, so I'm going to ask a question I don't know the answer to, which I shouldn't do. Is this for all counties or just particular counties in Oregon?
Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative Hayden, no, this is only for counties larger than 650,000, of which only Multnomah County qualifies. The amended version of the bill is.
The amended, okay.
Yes.
All right, thank you. That's what I was trying to find.
So I have a question for it. It looks to me like it's permissive. It may credit the balance. And so why would you limit it to just Multnomah County? If am I reading it correctly that it's permissive?
I think that, Chair Kenny Geyer, I think that section is permissive because we also retain the ability to donate the property for those first four purposes that we outlined. I think that's why the may is there. We could still continue to donate those properties, but under this proposal, mm-hmm. We also have the authority to use the money for these stated purposes.
So this proposal directs the money to other services. It's not a permissive. It's a change in the allocation formula.
If we sell the property, yes.
And that's why you didn't make it to other counties, because other counties haven't asked, and it would have been changing it. Since it's mandatory, not permissive, it would have changed it for everyone else.
Chair Kenny Geyer, that is correct.
Okay. But if there were others that wanted to come forward and be a part of this, that could be possible in the future, correct?
Chair Kenny Geyer, the statute would have to be amended to reduce that population threshold, but yes.
Right. Representative Hayden?
A follow-up question. I'm still trying to get on here. Would this in any way change the process of foreclosing, meaning there's a process that counties go through, they try and identify the landowner, they send out a letter, they oftentimes wait a while. Would it change that process or speed it up at all?
Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative Hayden, no, it would not. This is at the process where the county owns the property, all redemption rights and all purchase buyback rights have now expired.
Follow up.
Yep.
I understand that. But there's a process that they go through, and many counties have a lot more leeway or discretion than other counties. As they go through that process, they might even, after the taxes are delinquent for 3 years, they might even wait another year,
another 18 months,
because it might not apply to your county, but rural area, people aren't contacted, whatever, they don't have internet, and so they start to write letters to neighbors. They're not required to do that,
right.
To try and find people. So my question is, would this change the policy, since now there's money identified for a certain group that advocates for that, to speed that process or take some of that leeway or discretion away?
Chair Kenny Geyer, Representative Hayden, as a follow-up. This will not change any of the current statutory language. Briefly, in my... obviously, we're all as the assessor, we assess the taxes, and then as the tax collector, we collect the taxes. Real property is the only security for those property taxes. After 3 years of delinquency, which takes about 4 years from when they become delinquent in May, and then you get the judgment, then the county receives a judgment from the court. At that point, under statute, you receive a 2-year right of redemption. So you're allowed to stay in the property as long as you're not wasting the property, and there's statutory steps we have to go through if we wanted to reduce that. Typically, that does not happen. So during that 2-year right of redemption, the person still owns the property, we have a judgment. after that 2 years is up, if they have not redeemed that property, and numerous properties are typically redeemed that during that period up until the last moment. After that 2 year right of redemption period, we get the judgment from the court. We enter that as the tax collector. I deed the property over to the county, and at that point it is county owned property. So to answer your question, there is no flexibility on the county as owning the property to intervene prior to that point. And in many times, and it is not required but allowed under statutes in our county, we make every effort to allow the taxpayers to exercise their right if they can come up with the funds to repurchase their property, even after all their rights have extinguished. Our board and my chair, as I've worked with her, is committed to having that happen and helping people stay in their homes. This would be very limited to the point where we need to sell enough properties each year to pay for the program to work on it. And as a follow-up to your question there, what we do in Multnomah County is we actively go out and visit the properties during that redemption period to find out if they already need social service concerns. It's very proactive in working with our human services and social service workers at Multnomah County to try to intervene before we end up in that situation where we need to show up with a unfortunately, the sheriff and a writ of assistance. That's our least path. So in the end, the majority of these properties are vacant, they're deteriorating, and at that point, they become very difficult to manage. But I don't know if this answers your question, but in my staff, I have a foreclosure person that works with managing the properties and going out and visiting the properties, visiting the neighbors, and determining how can we help them so that we don't end up in that situation. I can.
So one more follow-up.
Sure.
Then I'll be quiet.
Sure.
So in the case, and you kind of started going down the road I was going down, in the case where you have a low-income family that can't afford their taxes that are in the house, and they can't afford them for 3 years, and they can't afford them for 5 years, would your $650,000 be available as a loan to those types of families so that they can stay in their house in the case where you have a poor family, so poor, so much in poverty, they can't even afford the taxes, yet we're going to remove them from that home for low-income housing? I mean, that situation must exist.
Chair Kennedy, Representative Hayden, I believe that would qualify under Housing Placement and Retention Support Services.
Okay. Thank you.
Nice to have that option.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, any other questions?
I have a comment.
Oh, sorry.
I just have a comment, a couple of comments. So so you said that there was an amendment that brought it just to Multnomah County, and what caused that, or was the prior that it would be every county, or what caused that change?
Representative Kennedy, Representative Peluso, we brought this proposal to the Association of Oregon Counties. There was less of an interest from other counties. It was also permissive to spend on all four services, so child, social, open space, or low-income housing. Once we decided to cut it down to just Multnomah County, it was always our intention to spend it on homelessness and affordable housing. So that's why we made both changes, to make it Multnomah County specific and to clearly delineate where we're going to spend the funds.
So being that my district is in Multnomah County and I live in Multnomah County, I am really thrilled about this bill. And having lived in Gresham for long enough to see the huge demographic shift and to see the huge need through all of Multnomah County, but certainly we have certain pockets of poverty that need to be addressed. So again, I appreciate this. I think it's the right thing. It's the partnering with social services. You know, for those who have heard me tell my police story when I was in law enforcement, that I got attached to Human Solutions, one of our social service providers out in East County, because I got tired of having my police officers trying to tell homeless people to go home. Because there's no home for them to go to. And so these are just huge steps. And I just will send kudos to Chair Kafori. She has stepped up to the plate and is really, really working hard for all of Multnomah County. And we love seeing her out in East County. So pass that on for me, will you?
Will do.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think it's a great example that other counties may want to follow in the future. Instead of how little dribbles go everywhere, really concentrate it and be able to do something with it. So that's great. Well, thank you so much. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3292, open a work session on 2194, and John Mullen, will you come up to be available to answer some questions? And Robin, could you please read the bill and the proposed amendment?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2194, as you may recall, directs the Department of Human Services to establish general assistance pilot project. It appropriates funding to DHS, sunsets the project on January 2nd, 2019. There is a dash 3 amendment pending. Briefly, it requires DHS to conduct program outreach, directs DHS to convene advisory group to develop evaluation metrics and benchmarks, and contract outside firm to conduct evaluation, compels report on evaluation to the Legislative Assembly on or before December 20th, 2020, prohibits the state from recovering any amount from a state, surviving spouse, property, or interest of recipient of general assistance except in specified instances. There is no revenue impact, and a fiscal impact statement has been issued.
Does everyone have a copy of this?
No, it's at NOLAS.
I didn't see it on
NOLAS.
It's there.
Did you see it on NOLAS? Okay, let's see.
Madam Chair, if you'd like to stand at ease for a moment, we can get copies for everyone on the dais.
It might be because I'm not on the staff login page. So if everyone logs in, I just want to make sure that everyone has access. The 2194 fiscal impact. Because this bill does come with a price tag.
She's looking for the fiscal impact. She's there.
I'm sorry, the wrong bill.
She was wrong. Okay.
Sorry. Just to make sure it's fiscal impact. Okay, there it is.
Does everyone see that?
Under materials? Okay. So you read everything.
Yeah.
Okay. So John, could you just remind us on what the proposed amendment does? It kind of narrows the focus of the pilot, and maybe a little bit about the fiscal. It's about $3 million for both bienniums, and a little bit about how that will be spent.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center, and also in the audience, Erica Miller from the Department of Human Services, if we need assistance from the department. Basically, the committee, of course, heard the report that was done on general assistance, where we gathered not only advocates but state agencies, and we had an outside reviewer that took a look at the literature, what other states do, and we came to the conclusion, the General Assistance Steering Committee that has been working on this advocacy since 2007, while we would very much have loved to recommend opening up the general assistance program as it once was, we recognized that we needed to really establish with the legislature the value of providing these types of services and helping people to become self-sufficient. So in that way, we really very much narrowed the project, and we also are building on existing infrastructure within the Department of Human Services. And so just in the main, and basically your staff gave a very good overview, but this particular pilot project would work with about 200 individuals. The great majority of those people are already identified. They're in the Medicaid presumptive Medicaid program. The presumptive Medicaid program was really in part established when general assistance went away. There was no assistance for people to help them get disability benefits, but there was a need for medical assistance for that population. And so these are people that meet the criteria, both income-wise and disabling conditions, where they have disabilities that will last for a year or longer. Again, this is a population that's often referred to as the poorest of the poor. And so with a subset of that group, because there are over 3,000 people in that presumptive Medicaid program, we decided to single out, in fact, what is perhaps the most difficult population to work with, those people that we already know to be homeless. From the literature review and the work that we did, we helped to establish in our thinking that a housing first model was going to be a better way of going than the way general assistance was in the past of giving a cash grant. There's a small amount of money that would go to clients, about $60 a month for personal incidentals, but the rest of the resources would go to provide housing assistance for those people. The most important and critical component of long-term self-sufficiency for that population is the work that would be done by the Department of Human Services, and they already have this existing expertise to help these people be able to qualify for the disability benefits. You've all read a lot about how difficult it is to qualify for disability benefits, how long waiting lists can be. So having somebody that's in this person's corner, working with them, helping them to get to medical appointments, proving their disabling conditions, helping to connect them to the mental health services that they might need or physical health services, working with community organizations to provide wraparound services, we're really very confident that this is going to show success. But in order to prove that back to the legislature, we also built in an evaluation. We will start with an advisory committee that would work on metrics. How are we going to measure our success? And then to have an evaluation of how we've done. The one thing that I would mention about the fiscal, and then I'd be happy to stop and answer any questions, is that the Department of Human Services did terrific work on the fiscal. They also, we worked very closely together in talking this all the way through. But one of the problems in the past was the fact that the front-end loading of the program with providing the services, oftentimes the fiscals in the past didn't show the savings in the out years, and this one clearly does. So if you can see on the at the bottom of the fiscal that the cost to the state is less than $2 million. It's going to be about $1.89 million over the two biennia. And that's because once the people get the benefits that the federal government say, okay, you're eligible for SSI, SSDI, or a combination, then they have a retroactive grant that goes back to the time of application. And those dollars, the retroactive dollars, are applied to the services that they receive, the housing services and the personal incidental funds. So in many ways, this is again, working with a very vulnerable population that have lots of needs. But I would just maintain that this is a very cost-effective a way of working with that population, and one, again, where I think we'll have great success.
Questions?
Thank you, John. It sounds like a really good program. Can you tell me how are you going to account for people who apply but are denied?
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Gallegos. We expect that because of the population is already judged to be eligible for federal disability benefits. This is why they're in the presumptive Medicaid caseload. But there will potentially be some people that will not be able to qualify for one reason or another. And that's a part of the estimate about the recovery. So there's a possibility that we will have a few people in that population that won't ultimately qualify, and then we have accounted for that as far as the savings is concerned.
Thank you.
Thank you. So the fiscal's not on here? Because I'm not.
It is, actually. It's under materials. I didn't, for some reason, didn't see it at first either.
I'm not seeing it. So question would be, since I don't have that in front of me, help me out again. We're asking for how much money, and it is how many people you think first you're going to serve?
This is easier.
We'll have some copies.
Here we go.
Printed.
Okay.
We'll come back at you there.
We'll have copies printed.
Got the money part. So how many people do we think this is going to serve?
200.
For $3 million?
Mm-hmm. Excuse me, Madam Chair, Representative Parrish. If you think about it with after the recovery, it's about $10,000 per person. Now, when you think about the cost avoidance that happens with this population often winds up in being in emergency rooms as a last resort. Many of them, unfortunately, cycle through the public safety system, and many of them also wind up being repeatedly in homeless shelters and other. So, in other words, one of the things that the Salt Lake City model that we looked at with the Housing First model, they demonstrated for the population that they served, they actually saved money by doing a Housing First model with the very vulnerable populations. And so this is in part, and Representative Parrish, I think it's a great question to raise, because we really want to demonstrate that what we know about potential cost avoidance and the effectiveness of this program, that we will hopefully be able to come back to a future legislature and say we've proven the efficiency, the effectiveness of this program, and we want to open it up to additional people.
I have a follow-up question to that. Is it 200 people total? It says 200 per month. Are you expecting the same 200, or are you expecting some will get their SSI during that period and new ones will come on? I see.
Thank you for that question,
and
Madam Chair.
Would DHS like to come up and answer some of these questions too? Thank you so much.
While Erica is coming up, is that one of the things that we do is we look at the total caseload, and the caseload will ramp up. In other words, we don't expect on day one that DHS is going to be serving 200 people. There's going to be some effort that's going to be needed to make sure that we locate people, and the caseload will grow over time, but it gets to a maximum caseload of 200. So there could be people that could be in and out as long as we stay below that maximum.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Erica Miller. I'm a program manager with the Department of Human Services, Aging and People with Disabilities, Collaborative Disability Determination Unit. To answer your question, Madam Chair, the fiscal does account for people coming into the program and then leaving once they're awarded benefits and new people coming in to take their place. We don't have the number of clients, total number of clients served added up here, but we could certainly provide that for you at a later date. It is much more than 200 clients total.
Mm-hmm. So it's 200 at any one time.
Exactly.
That's right.
Representative Bueller, then I'll get back to you.
So help me with who your control group is going to be. How are you going to reach conclusions?
Madam Chair, Representative Bueller, in the human service arena, we don't often work with control groups, but in fact, we will have other people within the Medicaid presumptive caseload. But the fact that we're focusing on people who are immediately homeless, I'm not entirely sure we have a good comparison group. But that's something because they're smarter people than I that would be able to lend some research rigor to this, and this is why we also would have an outside evaluation. But in and of itself, this is a population that exists statewide, so there's not going to be a comparison county to county looking at a control county, for example. But to the extent possible, we do want to provide rigor to this discussion so that we can come up with the proper facts on this. So I'm not answering your question directly, but I hope you understand that it's a difficult one to think about. And in human services programs generally, we don't often operate with a control group and an experimental group.
Well, I disagree with that. There's all kinds of studies, and that's the best thoughts on social policy right now is to have real program evaluation with control groups. So I think you need to fact check that one. Who's one? Two, why wouldn't this be best oriented in a CCO instead of human services? If we're trying to integrate social services, physical health, and mental health, why are we doing this in a non-CCO?
Oh, thank you for that question, Madam Chair, Representative Bueller. In fact, all of these people are in a CCO unless they have an open card. This is one of the parts of the study that we emphasize that one of the things that changed since 2005 when the program was defunded is that we now have health transformation and CCOs. And so the CCOs have, as part of their charge to provide person-oriented services for people, integrating services for people of mental health, physical health, dental health. But they have within their charge people who have no place to live and no direct opportunity to get stability like they would through disability benefits. So a very high percentage of these people will be in CCOs already.
So how would this program integrate with CCOs? How would the CCOs know what's going on? How's the
Madam Chair, Representative Bueller, you may recall that we had a woman who testified, Lisa, who works with CARE Oregon, and she has a case management role working with people, and she identified that she does a lot of things to work with that population but doesn't have that SSI, SSDI kind of component to her work. So we definitely want to have every single partner that we can have working with us, including the Aging Disability Resource Connections, but definitely the CCOs would be a major partner in this.
Okay, Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Chair. Kenny Geyer. John, thank you so much for doing this. I know you've worked so many years on this, and you did such a wonderful job. I remember when you explained to me how this started during the Depression and went away, and it's too bad that it went away, and I'm so glad that you're trying to bring it back. So thank you for all of your hard work on this. Obviously, I support and want to have funds go to what you have called the poorest of the poor, and it's really important that we help that population. I did want you to kind of walk through me some of the FTE requirements. Support this, want this to happen, you know, I think we should maybe talk a little bit about, so everyone here understands, my fellow committee members understand, the FTE does seem a tad bit high in proportion to the, if I'm reading this correctly. So I just kind of wanted you to walk me through that, please.
Madam Chair, Representative Taylor, I think it would be best for DHS to walk you through that. One of the things that that I would say before Erica responds is we had discussion about keeping the FTE count as low as possible and utilizing existing staff. Mm-hmm. Keeping in mind that you know, I often think about programs from a magnitude and intensity kind of issues. Mm-hmm. So, for example, if this was a program to provide home-delivered meals to a certain population, the cost of the meal would be low. The numbers of people that could be served, the cost of the program would be relatively low, but could serve lots of people. So this is serving fewer people more intensively. But I think Erica.
Okay,
could
so that is an intention. Yes. Okay.
Representative Taylor, Madam Chair. So the positions that you see on the fiscal, there is a Human Services Specialist 1 position, and that's a position that would allow one person to issue the payments for all of the program recipients. So that person would be issuing the housing assistance payments, the utility assistance payments, as well as the $60 personal incidental fund payment. There's also...
That's one FTE. What does that cost?
Yes. The total cost in the first biennium is $112,000.
Oh, okay.
The second position is an Office Specialist 2 position, and that's really a position to track payments, to ensure quality assurance, to do any follow-up work that's needed on the payments, and also to provide administrative support for all of the people who are helping with this program. And then the third position listed is an Accounting Technician 3 position. That's a position in the Office of Financial Services, and it's the person that actually takes in all of the reimbursements from Social Security, does all of the accounting associated with that to ensure that we're collecting the correct amount and that any overages are returned to the consumer.
Okay, thank you.
Yes, Representative Stark.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. John, I'm overall in support of this concept. One of the things that's concerning me as I look at the fiscal right now is when I subtract the non-reimbursed amount, okay, if 15% of the money or of the people that we qualify end up, you know, we never get those Fed reimbursements, that's, you know, $569,000. But out of a price tag of $1.8 million, almost $1.9 million, that leaves $1.3 million in overhead, which is almost a 35% overhead. Mm-hmm. And I know a lot of international and, you know, national nonprofits that run on less than a 10% overhead. So I'm concern why, just as overall, why a 35% overhead on a program like this?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Stark, and I know Erica will want to also respond to this, but some of the costs are not recoverable. The service costs are recoverable when the person gets the grant. Again, this is, I will acknowledge that this is something that's very staff intensive. It's a very difficult population to work with. What has been shown, though, is from our research that we've done, is that the cost avoidance in other areas is also powerful. But if this is a program that a general human services program, and I think the committee is aware of my previous role in being director of a county agency, where we also had the general assistance program and we had staff dedicated to that program. But there are other programs that we administered that had a 10% administrative cost, but there were others that were higher based on what kind of intensity there was with the program. So if you have to have, for example, social workers, or if you're in the mental health system and you have to have a psychiatrist involved with people, I mean, those costs will be different by different programs. So I am very much in favor for all of my career of keeping administrative overhead as low as possible. And believe me, we had lots of discussions back with the department about making sure that we would keep the staffing cost and administrative cost as low as possible.
If I may add something as well, Representative Stark and Madam Chair, the figure that you're looking at actually also represents the cash and assistance payments that are not recovered from the client. So that what you're seeing in the $1.89 million is not actually overhead, administrative overhead. When you're looking at the position costs for 15, 17, and 17, 19, it's $277,000 in 15, 17, and $271,800 in 17, 19. So you're looking around, you know, $550,000 for the staffing costs. And when you look at the total cost associated with the program on the bottom line, you're looking at over 15, 17, and 17, 19. It's almost a $6 million program. However, a lot of the program funding comes from those reimbursements. So that's over $2 million in reimbursements the first 4 years. And then those reimbursements continue to come in after the pilot ends, which is the estimated amount to be recovered that falls below of $1.9 million. Those are the reimbursements continuing to come in after the end of the pilot project. So that net cost is $1.89 million.
Mm-hmm. Follow up on that?
Sure.
We don't have to hash through all that at the moment. I'd be interested in sitting down and going back through those numbers, because I just did a quick math of total cost of the program, 15% that we didn't receive back, and assumed everything else is overhead. And so those, what you just said and how I'm understanding what I'm reading don't quite match. And so I would be interested in meeting with you and kind of going back through that.
I'd be happy.
I was trying to get at the overhead in a simpler way, which was on your third bullet. 85% of the clients served in this pilot program will ultimately be deemed eligible, and of those, the state will collect 82%, which left me thinking that there was 18% overhead.
Oh, no, that's 18% is unrecovered, and I'm sorry for not introducing myself correctly, but yes, the reason for that is that 18% is not recovered. Usually that's because when a client has a hearing with an administrative law judge for the Social Security Administration, oftentimes that law judge will assign a disability date that's different than the client or consumer alleges, which means that we began paying this benefit at a certain time when we deemed that the individual was disabled, and Social Security decided, no, we believe you're actually disabled 3 months later. So there's a very small period of benefits that we paid out that Social Security will not reimburse us for. Mm-hmm. So that's why there's a difference in the percentage of what's recovered. It's not 100% every time.
Okay. More questions down here. Representative Bueller, then Gallegos, and I think there are two over here.
Thank you, Chair Kittinger. Help me with what your theory of change or hypothesis is in this pilot. What are you hoping to prove?
Oh, Madam Chair, Representative Bueller, what we are hoping to prove is that we can provide stability to this population. One of the things that would happen when people are awarded the benefits, then they are able to live on their own. But in the interim, the connection with mental health, physical health providers, reattaching them to the services that help them to be self-sufficient. So we have a population that is being very vulnerable. We know that after the general assistance program ended, for example, there were people that died or that couldn't be found. And so the hypothesis, and again, this is why we want to bring in some people that really are good at the evaluation, but that that we are providing a long-term benefit for people, the people that we serve, and we also have cost avoidance for the taxpayers. So those are a couple of things that we're hoping to demonstrate by this. And frankly, just to be perfectly candid about it, is that I have had a lot of experience with this population from the past. And I just think that that with your concurrence, we want to be able to provide services to people who are really in a very vulnerable situation and hurting. But in answer to your question, we do want to provide the kind of rigor that supports getting to a place where we can allow more people to be served.
Representative Gallegos.
Thank you. My question is really along similar lines, and maybe Erica, you could answer. My assumption is the hypothesis is really about how do we create a more humane program, service program, and then secondly, how do we really cost issue, how do we provide services and save the state some money. But there's a lot of moving pieces, obviously, in this. And so my question really has to do with evaluation. Are you talking to the Regional Research Institute, or is there, you know, I didn't see sort of the plan for, to me, it's very difficult to sort of do control groups with this kind of population. What are you going to do, withhold services from one group or have a placebo for another group? I think, but I assume that you are working with, like I said, Portland State or somebody.
Yes, Representative Gallegos, Madam Chair, that is correct. We are not actively working at this time with the Regional Research Institute on Human Services for this work. We did ask them for an estimate of what this evaluative work would cost, and that's what's reflected in the fiscal. I believe a piece of the amendment talks about working with the evaluator to determine metrics, desired outcomes. That would be a piece of the pilot.
Thank you.
Down here. Representative Parrish?
So I appreciate the work you're trying to get to, and you're going to get me on a day when I'm just have a lot of distrust for the budgets that agencies are bringing us. And I've spent quite a bit of time, actually, in the last 4 years in the state's checkbook, which is really different than you bringing me a sheet of paper that says that your services and supplies is going to be $108,000. And, you know, just one little line item in the budget, in your DHS budget, that's actually in your checkbook, invoices paid out, $30,000 for meals for staff, and you're here asking us for money for folks, and I can pull $108,000 for out of meals that were paid for out-of-state meals, by the way. They were traveling out-of-state, and we paid $30,000 in 1 year for their meals. So when I look at, and I'm working for the next 8 weeks on a project to pull all these things together, so today I'm not comfortable passing a bill, even though it's well-intended, when meals for out-of-state and meals and professional development is $108,000 for 1 year, and you're asking me for, that's a piece of this money. And we talk about getting money to the front lines. I don't have a lot of trust in the DHS budget. And those are just two little line items that are expenditures that we've paid in 1 year. There's more of that coming. So I'm just, and it's not your fault. It's not your budget necessarily, all of it. But my level of trust with what we're being told in this building is really low this year. So I appreciate the policy. I'm just not going to get to yes right now on budget asks for new things when I'm not seeing that we're getting good value for out of our checkbook. Mm-hmm. And we keep saying we need more money and we have budget shortfalls, and that's really problematic for me that we're not asking those questions as legislators. I'm going to start putting that lens on every bill that's coming, and you're sort of getting the first lens. Sorry.
So, I mean, and I also want to remind us, my intention right here is to have you ask as many questions as possible to get clarity, and then I'm going to take a quick recess and stand at ease for whatever the language is after we ask questions and check in. But, you know, I do want to remind people that our job here is to say, is this good policy going forward? And then the subcommittee's job is to really look and pick it, because we don't often have, you know, we're not comparing all the different budgets that come before us. So,
and I appreciate, I'll just push back real fast, Chair. I appreciate that. We do, you know, get to say what's good or not policy. Yep. Our Ways and Means subcommittees aren't doing this work. They're not asking these questions. They're not saying, what's in your service and supplies? Because I'm now sitting on one of those, not for human services, and those questions aren't, we're sort of just like hearing people's budgets, and we're not asking those questions. And so wrapped up in service and supplies is things like catering and meals for staff and things I consider non-essential. So I can't in good conscience, even from a policy perspective, when the policy comes, we just moved it down to Ways and Means with no referral, but we're also referring this. And I just can't get there anymore. I've been doing this now. This is my fifth year in this building, and we keep sending these budgets down and asking taxpayers for more money with no accountability. And the program is really good, but what's in the service and supplies? Don't just bring me this in a fiscal anymore. I'd actually like to see the budget that goes with it and then make a policy recommendation that says I can support $3 million. So it's just personal preference at this point for me. I appreciate what they're doing, but when I see, you know, reimbursements to people for $10,000 for travel, I want to know how this money's really going to be spent, because $10,000 for one employee being reimbursed for travel means that somebody, the $10,000 per person you just told me would serve this person, that money's not going to somebody who needs it. And that's, right. I'm very pro-social service. This building knows that, but I'm sort of at my tether with seeing us send these things down and then the Ways and Means folks aren't doing their job. Somebody's not doing their job.
So I get that that's a frustration of yours. I think it is more of the subcommittee responsibility. I think the questions are really fair because there are two of us here that are on the subcommittee. You're getting your questions and concerns on the record, which I think is important. We will certainly carry that on to the next stage. But I think, again, asking some of the questions for clarification is important. Asking questions about, since the evaluation is a part of this, you know, how valid do we think the evaluation is? I think those are appropriate questions. Is the population that we're trying to meet the needs of, 200 people who are homeless, some of the hardest to serve? And the and because asking those kind of questions gives you the opportunity to say, once those people, if we can save money by not having them fall into greater health care costs because they're on the street, we can save money during that time by having them housed and have someone try to help them get on SSI, which if they didn't have that, they may not get onto SSI, and then the returns continue to come back. We're looking at a very short period of time, and so you're capturing some of the returns, but those continue down the line. Those are the things that make me interested in this policy. I do have some budget questions, and one question I have is, why do you have evaluation in both biennium? Are you planning on doing an evaluation in both biennium?
Madam Chair, the reason we were including evaluation in both biennials is because historically this population is extremely difficult to track. They're very transient. And we know that if we engage the evaluator to do evaluation at the very end of the study, we'll lose track of half, if not more, of the participants and not be able to gauge outcomes. So they really would like to be engaged the entire time so that they can get a better handle on what the true outcomes are for the length of the pilot.
Okay, Representative Buehler.
Thank you very much, Chair. Where will this study be conducted, the geographic location?
Representative Buehler, Madam Chair, as written, this is a statewide pilot.
And I'm guessing if there's not a control, they can look back on what these populations are costing our healthcare system, et cetera. How many are, you know, I don't know how many there are of this population. If there's 1,000, you're picking 200 if there's 1,000. But, you know, what are the healthcare costs? What percentage of these go on to SSI compared to the 200? So it may not be the traditional control group, but you would think there'd be some way.
Well, you
to
could
look
do
back
lots of controls. You get historic controls.
Right.
You can't tell me there's not more than 200 people that are not going to be entered.
Right. I would think there would be a way to.
Madam Chair, just to respond to that, right. We would be happy to consider any question that the committee would have about right. how to best judge the effectiveness of this program. Again, you know, our interest as social service advocates, the General Assistance Steering Committee, yeah. we're interested to serve the population, but we're interested to demonstrate to you that it's worthwhile doing this, not only from a humane position, as Representative Gallego said, but also one that's cost-effective. And so we would be very much open to any ideas that you have or direction from the Ways and Means Committee if this moves out of this committee and goes on to be funded. In other words, there's no pushback from us as advocates to say we want as much as you do to have really good, clear information on this because, again, we're hoping to extend this program to additional people.
Okay. One more question, and then do you have a question too? I want to stand at ease after.
Okay, no, go ahead.
No, that's all right. If there's something that's going to help clarify, you have a question too?
Nope.
Representative Taylor.
Thank you, Chair Kenny-Geyer. I really appreciate it when people look at the numbers for money. It warms my heart. Spent mm-hmm. years working as a management auditor, and it's I'm always amazed that people don't pay more attention to the dollars, and I appreciate that, and I appreciate that among my colleagues. And I do respect my colleague here, Representative Parrish, in trying to understand how some of the expenditures occur. However, I would like to just encourage, this is not meant necessarily towards you, but for all of us, to really make certain that we're sitting down with the appropriate people to have the expenditures explained, and it may be true what you're saying or may not be true. I don't know, because I don't know exactly what you're referring to, but a lot of times there are reimbursements. An employee may be reimbursing to that account that's being tracked a different way. There may be an outside entity that's reimbursing things. It's just important that the transparency websites are often good. However, it doesn't necessarily always explain how all the money is being spent or collected, because a lot of times people think, oh, we get all this money from these various things, and then it's actually a pass-through. And there's all sorts of ways in which the numbers can be analyzed. And so I just encourage all of us to really make certain that we're understand all that in detail. But in addition, having the almost 3 years that I volunteered for Representative Tomei and working on sex trafficking issues, if we want to talk about expensive populations to serve, they could pretty much win the prize. And so it is true, I would be more than confident saying here on the record that there is a variation in costs, and I've spent enough time with the Department of Human Services populations to really come to understand that. It's really been explained to me how different some populations are just very, very expensive to serve. But there is a benefit to it, and it is about being humane to that population, and it's about hopefully we would want to have less cost for the state in the long run. But we do have people who are really, really suffering and really need our help. So I just wanted to say that.
Well, and I think I'll just say before we stand at ease, you know, I took the $3 million, which is roughly the expenditures over both periods, and then what you recouped within that period, right? It's about half. So you're expending about $6 million over the next two biennium. You're recouping approximately half of it, at least at this point in time. Presumably, you would make more savings because people have been signed up for SSI after that. But just during that period,
that's right.
If you only serve 200 people, 200 into $3 million is $15,000 per person. Mm-hmm. Presumably, you're going to have more than the 200 because some will come on, some will come off. So even more can end up with the SSI payments in the future. Mm-hmm. And so while I have concerns as I look, okay, well, do you really need to spend that much on evaluation overall? When you think about the kind of savings that you can get from the healthcare system and the money that will come in over time, seems reasonable. But again, you know, the Ways and Means Committee will take a harder look, and I think that concerns that have been expressed, you know, are appropriate here. The policy is one that I think, again, the General Assistance Program to me made so much sense. I'm sorry that we can't do the whole thing. I think picking a population that's the hardest to serve, that costs our system a lot, and that will show us how do you really make the links with the CCOs? How do we make sure that CCOs, what are the pieces of this that CCOs can be picking up, either from the case management side, because they're dealing with the high flyers? Mm-hmm. You know, can we be shifting some of that away from DHS and toward mm-hmm. case management in the CCO system? And even housing payments. You know, I would love to see CCOs start helping support some of the people when they know that the bottom line is they're going to save money in the end. So I see this as an opportunity for an innovative way to start getting at some of those questions with one of the hardest to serve populations. So I'm going to leave it at that right now and stand at ease for a minute and have my vice chair check in.
So give it a couple.
Oh, okay. Stand at ease. Sorry.
Can we shift?
Thank you. I'm going to reopen the work session on House Bill 2194. Had some good discussions, never as much as we would like to have, but I would like to I would like to move ahead with the proposed amendment, the dash three. So,
Chair Kenny Geyer, I move to adopt the dash three amendments dated 4/2/15.
Chair Peluso moves to adopt the dash three amendments dated 4/2/15. Is there discussion on these amendments? Okay. Is there an objection to these amendments? All right. If not, the amendments are adopted.
Chair Kenny Geyer,
yep.
I move House Bill 2194 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Vice Chair Peluso moves House Bill 2194 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there discussion? Representative Buehler.
And I'm very supportive of the concept, and I really like the idea of doing pilot evaluations of such new ideas, but I don't think there's enough rigor here. I don't think the hypothesis is stated well enough, and I'm skeptical that DHS has expertise to manage a $6 million study like this. So I'm a no vote.
A $6 million study? You mean a study on a $6 million project?
Pilot.
Okay. Representative Hayden.
Hayden. Just a quick thank you, Chair Kenny Geyer. I've been involved with a lot of nonprofit works, applying for grants, and actually being going through that process, being interviewed, and whether you want to call it a 35% overhead or not, that type of structure wouldn't ever get close to being qualified for the type of grant. So even though I really support the idea, we've got to find a way to get more efficient. I'm not so worried about the study. I'd rather see the money go right to the people because I believe in what you're doing. I believe that your heart's in it and your organization's heart's in it. I work with a lot of nonprofits, and they can do this a lot more efficiently. So if there's another way to structure it, I could get behind it. But in this structure, I couldn't support it.
Okay.
I also appreciate the concept. It's actually what we are trying to do in veterans, which we actually know is proven. There's proven about if we slide people over to their proper benefit category, it saves money. They've already done numerous studies on that, and we won't fund that in this building, which is very frustrating to me. So I do know that conceptually that concept of drawing down your federal dollar and connecting people to whatever type of earned benefit, we know that that works even without a study because it works in the VA side real well. I have concerns about how DHS is spending these dollars, and when I just see big line items for we're going to use supplies and services, but then I see supplies and services being expended in ways that don't actually get to the frontline person, I write the check to the individual. Like, I mean, that's a more economical way than having a study. The other thing I see with programs, and I should have brought it up sooner, but it popped in my head as we were outside, is that we put 3 new FTE into the state. This program doesn't work, or some future body, when heck, we had 15 of us turn out in the last session. Some future body says, oh, we're not going to go this path anymore. What happens to the 3 employees? And there's never a well-stated plan for do they just get absorbed by DHS? Do we riff them or fire them? What actually happens to the folks? And it's sort of mission creep of the agency without actually having, you know, a plan. And I'm just not seeing that here. So I know that the concept works, and the notion that we find people, align them to their benefits, get them something that they've earned. We're a donor state. I've said it before. I'll be saying that again. We send Uncle Sam a dollar. He does not send us a dollar home. Things like this could get us those dollars and make us whole as a state, because I actually think Oregon taxpayers get it done. But in terms of writing their checks to Uncle Sam, but I'm just not there with this, and I care about the concept. I have raised fees in this past on, you know, to do the veterans, you know, homelessness, and a big population that this could serve is those people, but I just don't think this is fully baked from a fiscal perspective, so I've got to be a no.
Representative Stark.
Thank you, Madam Chair. John, I have a luxury that my colleagues from the same caucus don't have when it comes to voting on this, and that luxury is that I am on the sub, so I get to have another conversation about the fiscal on this. So I can, in good conscience, support the policy, I feel like, support the policy, but there are some other conversations that we need to have that in order for me to support it on the fiscal part when we're actually having those final conversations, that in order to have my support at that point, we're going to need to have a few more conversations because I need to understand it a lot better than I do, because I am frustrated or concerned about the idea of what I perceive as a large overhead. So we need to talk through that. So because of that, I can move forward on policy-wise, knowing that I get to have input later, and I don't know, yet know where I'm going to be on that later until we talk through some of those things.
Representative Gallegos.
Yeah, I just want to say that I'm going to vote yes on this policy proposal, because I sat on the Ways and Means for Human Services last time, and I do understand the process that you will have a chance to then vet the financials on this, but as policy, I think we need to support this kind of program. Thank you.
Any other comments?
Just one quick one I forgot to say.
Sure.
As you know, we do a little bit of construction for the $500,000 in study here, you could literally build 10 low-income houses. I mean, you know, is the paperwork worth more than that?
If that's a question that I should answer, Madam Chair,
I don't know.
Feel free to answer.
Is that we from some feedback that we had from members of this committee about being interested in metrics and evaluation, and also following on from the study itself that was done in general assistance, we took that as a logical step. And I would just say that Representative Stark's comments about what Ways and Means might want if you pass this out of committee, we're very happy to work on whatever construction of this program that Ways and Means thinks it makes the most sense. And what we're trying to do is our due diligence around not only the humane aspect, but proving that this program is worthwhile. So that's the reason.
Thank you. I understand that.
Okay. So if any of the comments have swayed you in a different direction, feel free to express that through your vote.
I just want to ask one more question, because, you know, we've heard a lot about the Utah Housing First, which is actually a conservative-led effort. And
yes.
So if it's working there and we like what they're doing, I guess why don't we just go to what they're doing? Because if it's working there, now granted they could have different regional or geographical issues that we might need to genuinely look at. But if something's actually working and is proven, I think it's redundant for us to say, well, now let's study that, instead of just jumping in and saying, let's put some of those investments and just turn that on. And because I think what Utah's doing is fairly turnkey. They have urban centers like we do. They have rural population like we do, hard-to-serve populations like we do. So the notion that we're going to study something, I just think if we were serious about it, let's spend the money and turn on what Utah has and take whatever steps we need and spend our money that way. It makes a lot of sense to me, because I think the investments in housing are really important. And, you know, you brought up a great point. We're going to spend all this money studying it. You know how many of those little small houses? We sat on the housing task force for, you know, people are saying they need money. Let's just get the people the money and get the folks working to do the work.
Well, I do think that in our new model with CCOs, having a study, being reflective, trying to figure out what is the best model going forward so that we can expand it makes sense. But I think when the bill moves on to the next stage, I think it deserves more dialogue around that piece of it and the value of that piece of it, or could it be pared back? I think there's underlying support for the policy, and it's maybe around the edges that there's some questions. I'm going to be heartily supporting it as something that I think that our state should be doing. I'm sad that it hasn't been doing it for many years, and it's a step in the direction that I hope will be expanded, and I think we want to do that thoughtfully. But I think the questions that have been raised are fair to consider at the next stage. So did you have a question?
I had one last question, Chair Kenny-Geyer, and maybe it's for you or for perhaps Ms. Johnson, is that I just process-wise, when we this is obviously already going to Ways and Means, is there do we ever pass something and then say a recommendation to them about what we thought should be considered?
I think Representative Stark and I will be, you know, bringing the conversation, and that is why we try to have people on policy committees also serve on subcommittees.
So it's done through that vehicle.
Yes, and things can change at any point along the way. It goes from here to the sub to the full Ways and Means to the House to the Senate. So there are other, well, through the Ways and Means process are the opportunities to amend it.
I'm going to be voting yes on this because I really do believe that we need to have general assistance for the poorest of the poor. And I just feel like I've gotten to know John over the years here and last few years, and I really do just so very much believe that he is interested in doing this in a financially responsible way and does believe in being fiscally prudent and, if anything, would love to give every dime he, you know, could get his hands on to help people who can't help themselves. So I really do think that if I could somehow convince my colleagues here to vote yes and support and trust that that Representative Kenny-Geyer and Representative Stark can, you know, bring our concerns down, that maybe we can control a little bit of the overhead costs, I just think I'm quite confident that we'd be able to, the subcommittee would be able to work with John on those issues. So I just wanted to throw that out there.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Gallegos.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. I just want to kind of respond a little bit to Representative Parrish's concern, our idea. You know, it's very tempting to think about best practice models, and can't we just take a best practice model and implement it locally? But again, that just doesn't work, and we really need to look at, you know, how our community is different than Salt Lake or different than Utah, and as I said, this has got so many different moving parts. I think we do need and I think I've really enjoyed the discussion, actually, and it's been important that we have the rigor that's necessary, and I'm convinced that, I mean, I know that the Regional Research Institute has been a traditional partner of DHS, and I fully respect their work, and I anticipate this will also have that same kind of rigor. So,
I just want to be clear one more thing. When we do send policy down to Ways and Means and we get the fiscal at this level, part of that policy decision is, are we comfortable with a 35% overhead? And when we say yes, I mean, it's tied to, do we like, it's not just we're voting down the policy and let Ways and Means sort it out. We get the fiscal at this level to have that first set of eyes and say, are we comfortable with a high-cost program or high-overhead program? So the no vote doesn't, again, speak to the actual policy. It's the whole package, and that's what we do when we sit up here. And so I think it's important not to say, we'll trust Ways and Means to do it. My no vote today says, Ways and Means, there's a problem. It's going to go down to your committee because, you know, you have the votes to do that today. I get to have a second vote again at the floor. If you all fix it, I get to have a vote on the floor. So I think it's important that when we look at these things and we raise those flags, it's not just about the policy. We're also telling Ways and Means we're comfortable with what the fiscal says. And then you get to hash it out a little bit more and balance it against the overall budget. So
I would agree with that. If we had, there are different ways to express those concerns. If there were too many no's and this didn't go through, we wouldn't have that ongoing conversation. I think you know that there are enough votes going through, and so that is one way to express concern. I think the other is just putting it on the record as we're doing and continuing to have conversations. The other thing I want to say about that is that I'm sorry that the fiscal didn't get posted until today. And so, you know, you got caught surprised, I think. And, you know, had we had it a little earlier, and if there were concerns, and if we're all doing our good job of, you know, looking at it and going, whoa, wait a minute, we could have gotten some of these questions. So I just want to apologize also as the chair of this committee that the fiscal didn't get put on until today. But
one point of clarification.
Yep.
I didn't mean I personally could build the houses, have
that community. For the record, now that I said for the record.
I'm not a home builder.
Okay, so with that, we're going to go ahead and take the vote. Is there any further discussion?
Yes.
Clerk will call the roll, please.
Reb Mueller?
No.
Reb Evans?
Yes.
Reb Gallegos?
Yes.
Reb Hayden?
No.
Reb Parrish?
No.
Reb Taylor?
Aye.
Vice Chair Starr?
Maybe. Oh, wait. Yes.
Vice Chair Palooza?
Yes.
Chair Kinnegar?
Aye. Okay. Motion passes. And we are adjourned for the day. Close the work session. Adjourned for the day.
Already.
Session. Adjourned for the day.
Already.
Close the work.